The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined now by the former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. His brand new book, Never Give an Inch, is a fabulous read. I have been immersed in it for a couple of weeks. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Congratulations. You did not hear, but your opening music with Linda Ronstadt singing When Will I Be Loved?
Well done, Lou. Or Hugh, well played.
Yeah, well, I want people to begin with that anecdote because it sets the tone for the book. You are perhaps no holds barred when it comes to Washington, D.C. culture. And the Kennedy Center Honors is really Washington, D.C. culture. So a light moment. Tell people about what happened there.
Oh, Hugh, the State Department's responsible for putting on this big event to honor great Americans, talented Americans from music and the arts. Secretary of State hosted dinner on the evening before the big event. And, you know, these folks don't like the Republicans very much. They certainly didn't like me or the Trump administration. So my wife and I, Susan, were debating whether we should go. But, you know, we wanted to honor the tradition. Great people. Earth, Wind & Fire, Linda Ronstadt. There was a great group of folks. Very talented. And so we went to this event. It's intended to honor the musicians. And the Secretary of State does a little bit of introduction work. And so I decided to keep it both sincere to honor them and with a little bit of humor. And so I joked when I was introducing Linda Ronstadt to the podium, I asked the audience, I said, goodness gracious, when will I be loved? To, you know, harken back to one of her songs. Danged if she doesn't get up and look at me and look me straight in the eye and say, you're not going to be loved till you leave this guy Trump or something like that. Just the room, by the way, left and right in the room could see this was both inappropriate, nasty, mean, beneath the level of the nice evening we were having. When I just kind of chuckled, went on with our lives, fully expected in today's Washington, D.C., that those of us who believe in traditional value sets will be mocked by those who want to undermine our country. That's what Ms. Ronstadt was doing. It was most unfortunate and a little bit funny.
Now, Mr. Secretary, you've watched Washington for a number of years, a member of Congress, director of CIA, and head of the State Department. It seems to me everyone thinks it's always the worst of times. When George W. Bush was being accused, Bush lied, people died. President Obama was accusing his detractors of being racist. Donald Trump, Russia, Russia, Russia. We're going to get into that. Joe Biden now says the press is hostile to him on his document search. Is it, in fact, getting worse, or is it always the same? Because you note in Never Give an Inch, a lot of people lost their minds in the Trump years. A lot of and you name them. A lot of serious correspondents just absolutely lost their mind. So is it worse now than when you first got there? And is there any way that it gets back to normal?
You know, Hugh, your point's exactly right, Hugh. We always think that our moment is the worst. So I don't want to recap all of history. There were folks beating each other on the House floor in the 19th century. So it's always been tough here in Washington. We have been a rambunctious country since our founding. But I will say that there was something different about what we were doing. You see it Never Give an Inch. We talk about the fact that we broke a lot of Washington, D.C. norms. We broke a lot of foreign policy norms, establishment norms. And if there's one thing that is not tolerated in this town, it is those who want to separate from the establishment storyline. And in foreign policy, it wasn't working for America. We broke those rules. I think we and America benefited from that greatly. And so, gosh, I don't know. My guess is that, you know, there'll be a time when there'll be another president after President Biden. And if it's a Republican president, they will come after him or her just as hard as they did after President Trump. Those of us who don't worship the Washington, D.C. culture and establishment are always going to be frowned upon here in town and take a beating as a result of that.
You know, I am surprised that you're not in Davos this week. We are pre-taping this the week before Never Give an Inch comes out. And John Kerry's in Davos, so I just assumed that every former Secretary of State would be in Davos. Have you ever gone to Davos, Mr. Secretary?
Never been to Davos. Kind of not my vibe, you.
Yeah, you and me both. I got invited this year, didn't go. I want to ask you, though, about the Aspen Institute. The one thing that didn't get dragged in Never Give an Inch, and there's a lot of D.C. that gets dragged here, and we're going to get into that, is the Aspen Institute. I think it's been totally captured like the Chamber of Commerce by the left wing and now doesn't serve the function it used to serve. What say you, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, it's too bad. It's always been a place where ideas were to exchange. I think, in fact, they call it the Ideas Forum, something like that. I did go there once to speak. I was interviewed by Brett Stevens. There's an example of someone whose just brain melted down, right? Brett Stevens was someone for whom I still have enormous intellectual respect, but he lost his mind with respect to President Trump. He could no longer reason his way through problems and solutions, and except when we got it right, with a handful of exceptions. I went to the Aspen Forum. He was the unfortunate bystander when I spoke directly to the New York Times about something they had done that was devastatingly awful. They had named one of my best CIA officers. They put his name in print. I'd spoken to the publisher. I'd spoken to the editor, asking them to please not publish this man's name. We had to provide security for he and his family as a result of what the New York Times did. There was no news element to publishing his name. He had simply been responsible for large pieces of the counterterrorism operation for the last 20 years. He was running my Iran mission center. They didn't like that. And so they put his name in print, risking the lives of his family forever. It was indecent. That happened at the Aspen Institute. And I think it's a mark in terms of how they now have become part of this left establishment. And I wish they'd carve out a different space for themselves. They're better than
that. There is a blob. And one thing I love about Never Give an Inch is that you weave the ultimate message is beware, the Chinese Communist Party is our enemy. That's number one takeaway. Number two is Iran's right behind them and Putin is a wolf. But behind this all is the blob, the Washington, D.C. blob. And you recount a story of an interview with Andrea Mitchell. And I've known Andrea for a long time, where he said, Mr. Secretary, I'm wondering. And he said, Andrea, you're not wondering. And I love that. And now that it may be the secret to Donald Trump's success with America is they know there's a D.C. and they know there's a rest of the country. And everyone in D.C. is either with D.C. or they're with the rest of the country. Is my diagnosis correct, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, I think you're right. They can see now that there's this bigger space. There's 75 million people, even in this last election, who voted against this Washington blob that you referred to. The book talks about this establishment, how it interacted with our administration. I haven't known Andrea Mitchell for a long time, but she was just sitting in the State Department press room that day. And I write about this. She says, Mr. Secretary, I'm wondering, and that kind of sarcastic wondering. She wasn't wondering. She didn't even need to finish her sentence, Hugh. She wasn't wondering. She was trying to bang away to create space between myself and President Trump. And I wasn't going to let that happen. And so I had a little fun that day, too.
That was, by the way, as soon as you articulated it, that explained every interaction I've had with legacy media for the 4 years that President Trump was in office. They wanted me to denounce Trump. And because I did not denounce Trump, I was not their favorite person. But you got that in spades every day. Let's go to the most important. I think this will make the most news. There's a lot of news and Never Give an Inch. I think you kept a lot of stuff up your sleeve. But I remind people, Secretary Pompeo, when he was Congressman Pompeo, came on this show the day before he was named director of the CIA, when it was almost done. And I said, do you think Devin Nunes is going to be the director of the CIA? He said, that could happen, you. That could happen. So you're very good. And you held a lot of stuff in for Never Give an Inch. Did you do that knowingly, or did the writing of it lead you to go deeper and deeper? And second part, how long did this take to get cleared?
Goodness. Let me start with the second one. It was cleared by the State Department, the CIA, and this White House. They actually treated me decently. It took a long time, but we finally got it done. So everything in the book has been reviewed. There's no spillage. There's nothing sitting next to my Corvette. It's all good.
All right. You bring up number one. Before the document. Go ahead, second.
Anyway, we did it the right way. Look, the stories that I wanted to tell here were the history of what we did in the Trump administration and why we did it and the things we got right. And you've seen here, you've read it, the things we didn't accomplish, the work that still needs to be done to build a more secure America. So I wasn't going to write a book for the first, goodness, year of my time after service. I just decided I would do that 3, 5, 10 years from now. And then I watched, frankly, other administration officials write and the media begin to tell the story. And I wanted to recount, at least from my perspective, the things I saw and why it is we delivered what I believe was a more secure America for 4 years. It was a lot of fun to write.
I've tried to read every memoir that matters to me, and there are four before yours that I thought were good. Mike Pence's So Help Me God, Bill Barr's book was very good, Jared's book and Kellyanne's book were very good, even though the last two would like to strangle each other. Yours is the best because you're the only national security official who served from day one to the last day, four secretaries of defense, four national security advisors, four chiefs of staff. Is that a recommended operating procedure, Mr. Secretary?
You mean in terms of turnover?
Yeah.
that is suboptimal to be diplomatic. I've retained some of my diplomatic skills, I suppose. No, you really want to make sure you get the right team on the field from day one as best you can. Doesn't always work that way. But that transition, every time there was a transition to an acting Secretary of Defense or a confirmed Secretary of Defense, or as we switched out national security advisors, it meant a lot of relearning, a lot of tracking back through ground that we had already covered, different ideas. Maybe that's good. But my recommendation, a preferred solution would be to find the right team as early as you can, get them on the field, and then drive as hard as you can towards your objectives. I was a Secretary of State for 1,000 days, Hugh. I needed another 1,000 to complete the mission set.
You know, the CIA comes across as much more leadable than the State Department. When I put down Never Give an Inch, and I don't know that anyone else served in both capacities. I can't remember anyone else. But the CIA seems so mission-directed and secret that you could work your will on it with three political appointees. But the State Department, my God, I don't know that anyone is ever going to change it. Do you think it's possible?
You know, Hugh, I've run seven organizations, maybe eight, depending on how you count them, starting as the assistant manager at Baskin-Robbins. I think I left most of them better than I found them. But the State Department is a beast. Three unions, civil service rules. You gotta go fix that. It was 1,000 days of pushing back against a machine that had its own vision for how foreign policy ought to be run. It's not that there weren't some good people there. There absolutely were. There were some folks who were on the team, but that bureaucracy must be brought to heel. It has to do what the president asked it to do. I don't want it to be conservative. I don't want it to be liberal. I want it to respond to the president of the United States and his duly confirmed secretary of state. And it doesn't. You're right. Different kettle of fish at the Central Intelligence Agency. It was an organization that said, yes, sir, boss, got it. You want to go around left tackle? Here we go. And it made it a much more functional, much more efficient, and on behalf of the American people, a much more effective institution.
Let me start with a newsmaker in Never Give an Inch. At the CIA, when you took office, you immediately began to look into the Russia report that was used to ambush Donald Trump on the first January 6th, which you write, January 6th, 2017, is the first January 6th. That's when Comey, Brennan, and Clapper, plus you, not knowing what was in the document because you hadn't been confirmed, basically sabotaged the next 4 years. And you did an after-action deep dive at the CIA. Would you tell people what you discovered about the intelligence community Russia report that became the Russia hoax?
Hugh, I was asked to go to Trump Tower on January 6, 2017 for what may have been one of the most remarkable meetings. I was still just a backbench congressman from Kansas awaiting my confirmation process. And there you have Director Comey, head of the FBI, Director Brennan, head of the CIA, and Jim Clapper, the head of the DNI, all basically tell the president he's a Russian asset. They've got this document that became known as the Russia ICA. It was the foundational document that Adam Schiff used to lie to the American people about the Russian hoax, the fact that our administration was cuddly to Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump was a Russian asset. It was false. It was based upon a series of lies about this Steele dossier that was later used in the FISA courts. And I now can see they were convinced that they were telling the president something they knew had no foundation. And I saw it. So when I got to the CIA, not quite on day one, but very, very quickly, I gathered the team that had done this work. It was actually some really talented analysts, but they had gone around the most senior leadership in the analytic department, two of the three most senior leaders there, who came to me and said, basically, we were X'd out. We were crossed out of the process. Director Brennan went around us. Then I came to learn that Director Brennan knew that the Steele dossier wasn't worthy of inclusion in the ICA. He kind of went back and forth. It ultimately ends up in a footnote. Of the ICA, that was the compromise. But of course, we know, Hugh, we know the history. That becomes the foundational document upon which a president was impeached. And put aside Donald Trump, put aside Mike Pompeo. Those 2 years where this Russia hoax was the story of the day on nearly every major network across America reduced our capacity to perform our central functions. It lost focus for the president and me and others who had to deal with it. And it was all based on this idea that came out of largely the FBI.
Now, I would direct Congressman Jordan and any member on the weaponization of the federal government subcommittee of judiciary to read pages 112 to 116 of Never Give an Inch, because there it names names, and where it doesn't name names. I'm curious. You name the senior Russian analyst and a colleague who put in writing their objections to the CIA's report. They put it in writing and they came and they spoke to you, but you don't include their names. Do you think they will appear before the Jordan Committee? Ought they to appear before the Jordan Committee, or will the revelation of their name put them in danger?
No, I think these folks are now staging their career where they can testify, and they ought to be asked to. And if it needs to happen in a classified setting to protect them, that'll be a judgment that both they and the agency and Congress will have to make. If it has to be in front of in a classified setting, so be it. That story ought to be told directly to Congress.
All right. Now, I want to close with John Brennan. I have had my worries about this for a long time. You two are clearly not going to be dinner pals. But the last conversation you record in the book where he says he won't stand for what you are saying, you say, and you won't stand for the national anthem either, and you hang up. Have you talked to him since then?
Now, those may have been my final words to him.
By the way, the hoax lasted 4 years, page 118. We're going to leave it there. Russia, Russia, Russia. Mike Pompeo deals with it. Let's get to important stuff. Well-timed in one respect. You write in this book, which had to have gone to press 6 months ago, 4 months ago, before Biden's documents showed up in the garage, this book was done. You deplore the double standard that applies to an E-5 in the Navy or a GS-12 at the Department of Energy handling classified documents and that which is now unfolding with President Biden. Would you explain the biggest double standard? It's not between Trump and Biden, though that one's pretty obvious. It's between the most senior people and the lower level people.
When I was a young soldier, we carried around something called a CEOI. It had some code signals in it, most of them made up for training. But when we put a lanyard on it, we had it in our pocket. It didn't leave our body. We knew that you're taught from the moment you enter government service that protecting this information matters. And when a young person puts material where it shouldn't be, they're reprimanded, whether it's an Article 15 review in the military or just a reprimand in their file. And our senior leaders are clearly handling classified information in ways that are even much more dangerous to America, but with almost no accountability. I saw it plainly when I served on the Benghazi committee, when there were more than 24 senior American officials who had classified information on their phones. They were going back and forth on their, I think it was Blackberries, including Secretary Clinton. And the results for them have been nothing more than a few words written. This is a terrible double standard. It certainly rivals, probably exceeds the double standard between how Biden and President Trump will be handled in their debacles. But no one, not President Trump, not President Biden, not an E-5 or an E-2 or a GS-5, none of them should put classified information in a space where it is not authorized. If you do it by mistake, get it back in there. But if you get it wrong too often, let's make sure we treat everyone the same, not by rank.
Yeah, Mr. Secretary, before you were out of high school, I had TSI clearances at DOJ, but I had three rules told me on day one. Number one, if you leave it on your desk, you'll be disciplined. Number two, if you take it home, you'll be fired. And number three, if you give it to anyone, you'll be prosecuted. Are those still the rules? That was long ago. That was in the Reagan years. Are those still the rules?
They are. Sadly, Hugh, they are applied very unevenly. Look, we all know senior executive branch officials have stuff in SCIFs that are in their house. They're doing a lot of work 24/7 around the clock. But there are rules, detailed rules for how this information is handled. You have staff to make sure that you're able to comply with them. And clearly, we've got senior officials who just haven't taken this sufficiently seriously. And accountability mechanisms simply, frankly, they just don't exist.
What do you think President Biden took to his garage, Mr. Secretary?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. I'll bet he does, in spite of the fact he tells us that he doesn't. And I'll be the first to admit that there are times that there's things that classified that, so be it. But it's classified. Right. The reason I submitted my book, Never Give an Inch, for review wasn't because I thought the world ended if a particular piece of data got out there. Oftentimes it wouldn't. But there was a decision made, a process made that said, no, we're going to try and secure this information. And for me, as a former soldier, that classified information protects our operatives around the world, our Marines in Okinawa, our soldiers that are stationed throughout the world. This information was classified through a decision-making process and a reason. And so I don't know what President Biden had there. It clearly was classified. We ought to all figure out how to hold senior leaders accountable when they make such egregious mistakes, to have this stuff in a garage that was clearly marked classified. I get it. Sometimes it's hard with an unmarked document to know exactly what level of classification. I'm willing to explore that, but there's just simply no excuse for having marked documents in a space and do it in a way that President Biden clearly appears to have done.
Now, this is my transition point to China, Mr. Secretary. Sources and methods matter, and keeping them classified and away from the Chinese matter because the Chinese kill them. Our networks in China got rolled up before you got to the CIA. Do we know why that happened? Do you have a suspicion why that happened?
I can't say much about that, but the predicate of your question, the understanding is right. We not only have responsibility to keep documents secure, classified documents secure and out of their hands, but when we are speaking on electronic devices, transmitting information along by electronic means, using communication systems that are designed to be secure, we've got to use them properly, rightly, only pass information through those systems that are appropriate. And there's a reason those rules are overprotective, Hugh, right? There's a reason they are prophylactic. They're designed to have a margin of error. And then when you have people run through stop signs, you can get Americans killed. And that's just simply unacceptable.
Now, Mr. Secretary, this question could get you into trouble if you eventually decide to run for president. So I warn you, it's coming. I have a great deal of confidence in Christopher Wray because Mike Luttig told me he's a patriot and he's very smart. Many people on the right wing in the Republican Party are very upset with Christopher Wray, including your former boss, Donald Trump. What do you think of the director? If you were elected president or you were advising the next president, would you urge a change?
Well, I'll answer the second one and then the first. I think the president of the United States ought to pick his own FBI director. I just think that makes enormous sense. Fine to provide him with some job security, but make no mistake about it, that every single person that works in the executive branch, even special counsels, we have a unitary commander-in-chief, a unitary executive, and those people ought to be responsive to that leader. It didn't happen for me at the State Department, and they ought to do that. If there's a political problem or somebody does something wrong, the president himself or herself is responsible for that. You can't say, gosh, my FBI director went off the reservation. And so, yes, it's not that I would want change from whoever the FBI director was, but I think every president should have the FBI director they selected and make sure that he or she is complying with the directives they provide to him or her. Second, I worked closely with Chris Wray on a handful of big issues, including, as I write about in Never Give an Inch, the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston, Texas. It was a excellently run FBI operation. And so I saw some great stuff that Director Wray did. Director Wray was pretty serious about China, although I think his current leadership is not as serious about it as he is. And then I saw things that I wish Director Wray had done better or differently as well. And I'm pretty candid. I write about those in the book as well.
Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt from Studio West, joined this morning live by New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. Good morning, Governor. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning, Hugh. How you doing?
I'm great. Now, I start almost every show, right before show, I read the Ellis items from Substack. I don't know if you know John Ellis. I don't know if you read it, but it's a good compendium of straight-up news. Today, he excerpts a Congressional Budget Office report that shows, quote, detailed Social Security projections finding that the trust funds are headed for insolvency by 2033 on a theoretically combined basis. Without legislative action, CBO estimates that the benefits would be automatically cut by 23% across the board upon insolvency. Well, that got my attention. I'm 66. I don't think they would ever dare do that to anyone at 76. But what do you think, Governor, and what should D.C. do about this?
Well, you got to take action because you don't, and you can do it. You can do it in a smart, fiscally responsible way without cutting benefits. And my point has always been that the Republicans are terrible on this messaging. Because every time Republicans talk about this, people say, oh, they're cutting your benefits, they're going to cut your Medicare, they're going to cut your Social Security. No, there are actually fundamental ways to do this that don't find a reduction in benefits, that do ensure its solvency. My fear is probably just like yours, that Washington is going to do what it does best, nothing, and just wait for the crisis to hit and deal with it at the 11th hour, which probably means they just try to throw, you know, print more money and throw more money at the situation without some of the fundamental restructuring that has to happen. But it absolutely can be done without the loss of benefits.
Now, Governor, what I routinely suggest is raise the retirement age to 67 or 8 and then add 1 month or 3 months every year thereafter because people are going to work longer. Means test Medicare more than it's already means tested. The means test, I pay the means test when I go on Medicare in a couple of months, and that's fine by me. I've got plenty of money. I don't think anything is hard. And then you tell people, if you're over 55, if you're 55 and younger, this is going to affect you, but if you're over 55, it's not going to affect you. Honestly, it's not that hard if you don't try and fix everything in one day.
Well, that's it. And to your point, the sooner you do it, the bigger runway you give yourself in addressing these issues. I'm a big believer in the concept of promises made, promises kept, right? So if you're in the system now, it absolutely shouldn't affect you, and these changes shouldn't affect you. But if you plan ahead, you can do it so any of the changes that come to that next generation, if you will. And again, it's not necessarily a loss of benefits. It's just fundamentally changing, to your point, how you test things. You can find efficiencies. Believe me, I'm the governor. I found a lot of efficiencies in New Hampshire, and there are so many efficiencies to be found out of D.C. The fundamental problem is this, you. How many members of Congress do you think truly understand how this stuff works?
Oh, I mean,
it's 5%. Really complicated.
5%.
Yeah, it's so few, right? So they are making judgments, policy judgments, on political headlines and talking points as opposed to really understanding systems. And that's always been my biggest frustration with anyone in government. I'm just a big believer. You got to do your homework. And if you don't understand something, you don't have to be an expert in everything, but you got to get folks in the room that really understand this and can put ideas on the table. I don't care what your political background is. Just give me some ideas.
Now, Governor, you're the MIT guy. I'm the Harvard guy. I believe in messaging. You believe in getting things done. My messaging.
You got A's. I fought hard for C's.
It's true, except in Harvey Mansfield courses. But I do look at the Republicans right now, led by Leader McConnell and Speaker McCarthy, and they have not yet agreed on their three must-haves in the debt limit negotiation. I think it's irresponsible for the president to say no negotiation. I don't think that will hold up. But only if the Republicans come up and say, we want these three things in June. What do you think of the Republican approach to the debt limit negotiations, which is not to negotiate right now?
Yeah, you got to negotiate. There's no question about that. I think you can have kind of a hard line and principles and say, look, there are certain things we absolutely must have. And then you go to the other side and say, well, tell me the things that you must have, right? And you find enough folks on both sides and get the must-haves in, and you leave the superfluous stuff out. You got to give a little to get a lot. And that can always be done, whether it's balancing a budget or managing. I mean, we don't really have a lot of debt in New Hampshire because we have a balanced budget and a surplus every year. My trouble is, most red states do, we have too much money, right? We're trying to spend our surpluses wisely, as opposed to places like California and Washington, D.C., that have these massive out-of-control deficits. So there is a way to do it, but again, you can be firm in your principles and what you stand for, but you've got to understand that the most important principle is you're going to be there to get something done and cut a deal. And that's it.
There are three buckets, Governor. There's non-discretionary spending entitlements. There's non-discretionary defense spending, which has got to be whatever you need. And then there's non-discretionary non-defense spending. On that last bucket, I think you can explain it and say to people, we're freezing that at 2022 or 2021 levels forever. And you're just going to live on that budget. Does that make sense to you?
Look, that's a start. I like that, but I'll give you one better. Just send it to the states, right? The concept of block grants. States spend money so much more efficiently than the federal government.
But Governor, let me interrupt you. That's not going to happen before June. That might be a long-term solution, but by June we got to negotiate.
No, I'm thinking more long-term. Yeah. No, that's it. Look, freeze the discretionary stuff. Of course, that's like a no-brainer to me. But long-term, because I try to think of these long-terms, you want structural solutions so we're not doing this again and again and again. And the answer, I believe, is you send the money to the states, you really gut the federal government, you drain the swamp. We were told it was going to be drained. It was never drained. But you drain the swamp, and you do that by forcing a balanced budget. I would say we're going to raise the debt ceiling with my left, with my right hand, and then my left hand, I'd say, and here's my balanced budget. So,
you know, Governor, I've been reading Mike Pompeo's new memoir, Never Give an Inch. Draining the swamp turns out to be a State Department that 95% liberal Democrats and left-wing Democrats, a FBI, a DNI. What would you do as president to try and avoid the ambush that Donald Trump got hit by on January 6th of 2017 when Clapper, Brennan, and Comey came in and ambushed him? I mean, it's clear from reading Never Give an Inch by Pompeo. It was a four-year guerrilla war by the left that's built into the swamp.
So I don't understand the question here. Are you asking how to drain the swamp?
If you're the president, what do you do about this vast bureaucracy, which is 97% left-wing?
You start, and this is what the former president never quite got. You do it by balancing the budget. Through that process, you cut all these vacancies. You send all the money down to states. You take the Department of Education, for example. You can cut it by, you can keep all the money, but you can cut it by 90%, and you get rid of all the bureaucracy. You send it to the states. You find massive amounts of efficiency in doing that, and you let states decide how to spend those dollars. You're literally saving 10 to 20% of your dollars, of your tax dollars. And look, the number one tenet I try to govern by is there is no greater responsibility than managing other people's money, because I didn't earn it. You did. It was your blood, sweat, and tears. It was your time away from your family. And whether it's in the private or the public sector, more public officials have to have that type of discipline. But it all starts with a balanced budget, because that's when all the cuts happen. That's when all the vacant positions that technically have to get funded because they exist get actually written off of the books.
Shrink the monster. I agree. But it also requires some management tools. Governor, we'll come back, talk policy, a little bit of politics. I do the policy first, I come to the politics. The Democrats are not giving up on screwing your state. I saw you on Neil Cavuto saying we're going first. How early will that be if it needs to be early?
Well, it's we always make our first in the nation primaries early as it has to be. Traditionally, it's in mid-January, early February, something like that. But our law says we have to come first. We will come first. America wants us to come first. We are the best first filter. We have such incredibly high voter turnout. Our system has integrity. We can actually count votes and get a winner that night. A lot of states are having trouble with that lately, but we can actually do that. And you don't need money and name ID to win.
If President Biden skips it, what will be the impact on him? And, there'll be some knucklehead running on the Democratic side, even if he doesn't have an intra-party serious nominee like Kennedy and Carter in 76. But what will be in 80? What will be the impact if President Biden skips the New Hampshire primary? Will he lose it in the fall of 24?
Of course. No, and it's not just he won't even get this is what's going to happen. You're going to have early states that, like South Carolina, right? They want to move the first nation primary to South Carolina. South Carolina is likely not to even hold a primary. They didn't hold one for Trump in 2020. They just said the incumbent is anointed. So they're probably going to do the same thing for Biden. It's going to be a huge open door for left-wing progressives that want to challenge Biden, that clearly have no respect for him and don't see him as the future of the party. The old out-of-touch white guy, as they called him in the primary debates of 2020, they're going to have that same attitude. So there's going to be a huge opportunity, not for a knucklehead, but probably for some substantial candidate to run here in New Hampshire, garner all that momentum, all that free media, all that press, come out of the first in the nation primary with a win, and really with that political momentum, blow right through South Carolina where they won't even hold a primary, right? And so now Biden will be in trouble.
Question for you, Governor. If he does follow through with his threat and skips New Hampshire, will the Granite State vote Republican in the fall as payback?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Those four electoral votes go to the Republican in November of 2024.
I agree with you. And I think that's what Democrats have got to figure out. Governor Chris Sununu, always good to talk policy and politics with you. Keep coming back. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back. Hour three of the Hugh Hewitt Show rolls along. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Mike Pompeo continues his conversation with me after the break. My new Washington Post column just went up. I wrote it over the weekend. I interviewed the former Secretary of State and CIA director last Thursday. The book is embargoed until, of course, it's available in bookstores. So I'm running the interview today. But I didn't talk about this with him. because it was so arresting. I wanted to think about it. And I wrote my Washington Post column instead about, I want to read it to you right now. As bad as news from the U.S. southern border has been lately, Mike Pompeo warns that it might get much, much worse. His insights as Secretary of State and CIA director during the Trump administration are causing him to warn of a possible Nuevo Unco, another 9/11, this time arising from the chaotic regions of Mexico. Pompeo sounds the alarm in his new memoir, Never Give an Inch. For some reviewers, the most timely content will be Pompeo's denunciation of the double standard that applies when it comes to the handling of classified material. Written before the drip, drip, drip of President Biden's document scandals, GarageGate anyone? The text foresees the lengths to which many in the media would go to minimize the offenses of a Democrat compared with a former President Donald Trump. Let's hope Pompeo is not as prescient about the lawless regions of Mexico. Quote, every American should know that today, the United States faces significant ungoverned spaces closer to such places as El Paso, Phoenix, and San Diego, Pompeo writes. Quote, significant parts of Mexico are no longer policed by the central government, he adds. There are entire well-armed militias, the private armies of Mexican criminal syndicates that impose their gangland rule without government interference. I add in the column, I'm not going to read you the whole thing, go over to WashingtonPost.com and find it for yourself. American audiences of the TV series Breaking Bad or the novels of Don Winslow or Ozark have a sense of the Mexican cartels, but not necessarily an understanding of the real world threat they pose. And it's not just the 107,000 overdose deaths in 2021, though most of those are have Mexican complicity and fentanyl complicity in them. It is also that this is an ungoverned space in which there is no civil authority to prevent the staging of terrorist attacks. And by the way, you say, why would they do that? They will draw the heat like Afghanistan drew the heat. Smaller cartels might very well want the United States to destroy Sinaloa cartel. I'll never say that correctly. Go read the column. It's a very serious part of the book. It was totally unexpected. And I didn't bring it up with him because I wanted to write about it. I wanted to think in, and it's now over at WashingtonPost.com, or just Google Hugh Hewitt and Washington Post. My friends at Andrew and Todd, they are great, great sponsors of this show. And every morning I check the 10-year treasury so I can tell you whether they're going to be able to help you today or not. So it's holding firm at 3.52%. So you might be able to get an interest rate in the fives. It might be in the sixes. Whatever the interest rate you'll get if you have to buy a new home, you will get the best rate from andrewandtodd.com, unless you're a veteran. You can always go to the VA direct and sometimes, but that, they also do VA loans at andrewandtodd.com, and I don't believe there's a significant difference between them handling it and the VA handling it, and certainly you will get private sector service from a private sector firm as opposed to a credit union. That's just Hugh Hewitt's view of the world, but I'm not bragging on credit union people. They do great work. I just think Sierra Pacific, which owns andrewandtodd.com, have not changed their name in 25 years for a reason. They are a lender that gets it done. They've been in the business for 25 years through ups and downs. This is currently a very difficult market to buy a house in because sellers are holding on to the prices they could have gotten a year ago, and buyers are saying, wait, we don't have the same amount of money we did a year ago. Someone's got to bring them together. First, you've got to get approved. You start with andrewandtodd.com, 888-888-1172, 888-888-1172. You head over to andrewandtodd.com. You can also just answer a couple of questions. They'll call you up right away. And from soup to nuts, they will get that loan done. They will give you a pre-qualification letter. And listen to me. I'm going to go a little bit long here. If you're a senior citizen and you don't have any money or your budget did not anticipate 8% inflation last year, courtesy of Joe Biden, or 9 or 10%, you didn't anticipate something in your life, an illness in your life, and you're suddenly struggling for money, you can get a reverse mortgage on your principal residence, even if it's paid off, even if it's got a mortgage on it. You can get money out of that house, and then you put it to a financial advisor. You don't spend it. You get the money out of the house, and you spend 4% a year on your annual budget. That's the rule of thumb. AndrewandTodd.com are specialists. I know both great Christian men. Call them at 888-888-1172 on your own behalf or on behalf of your parents and say, we're stuck. We got a house, but we're house poor. They'll help you. Mike Pompeo's brilliant new book, Never Give an Inch, part three of my interview with him, up next. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Hey, everybody. It's Dwayne Patterson of the Hugh Hewitt Show. The last time we talked, I was about 3 weeks into a 50-pound weight loss project with my PhD, weightloss.com. I had lost 16 pounds after 3 weeks. Today, I've lost 50 pounds in just 12 weeks and have been able to keep it off for the last 2 months. And you can, too. MyPhDWeightLoss.com has all the information, or 864-644-1900.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Richard Haass. Richard is president of the Nonpartisan Council on Foreign Relations. Good morning, Richard. Congratulations on the publication of The Bill of Obligations, your brand new book, the subtitle of which, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Welcome. How's The Bill of Obligations launching?
Good morning. How you doing? Long time no talk. It's flying, so we'll see how it does. I think it's struck a moment where a lot of Americans know there's something wrong, and they're looking for some answers, so hopefully they'll find a few.
Well, I've been teaching con law for 25 years, and you're not a lawyer, but you do a good job with the Bill of Rights and its origin. I compliment you on that. My favorite chapter is on remaining civil, and I'm going to go there, but I want to ask you a tough question out of the box. You are Manhattan Beltway media elite. Everybody knows it. Policy planning director, Morning Joe, New York and D.C. are your world. What have you done at the Council on Foreign Relations in the last 2 years since Trump left to make it more representative of red state America opinion and feelings?
We've been doing a couple of things in a long predated Donald Trump. Probably over 10 years ago, we decided that we needed to get outside our traditional role, just talking to people who had chosen to be part of the foreign policy conversation, our members and others. So we have started all sorts of programs. We have become, I believe, the largest educational institution in the United States, teaching Americans about the world, what we call global literacy. We have an entire curriculum up for free online, World 101. We have all sorts of other teaching resources for elementary schools, some that we do with iCivics, for high schools and for colleges and universities. So that's one big thing that we've done. Two, we're doing all sorts of public events around the country, again, to get out of just the Northeast Corridor. Thirdly, it turns out a plurality of our members now, close to 40%, has nothing to do geographically with either the greater New York or greater Washington area. So we've tried to become much more diverse, much more of a national organization.
Richard, on the payroll, is there anyone who is a Trumpist, anyone at all?
We probably have 20, 25 people who are members of the council who worked in the Trump administration, just to give you an idea.
Are they actual paid for by the council, their fellows?
I don't ask people, you know, what their politics are, how they register, how they vote. That would be wildly inappropriate. I myself, you know, was a lifelong Republican until about 2 years ago. My guess is we have a range on the staff, on our board. We have quite a few people who worked in Republican administrations as well as Democratic.
Yeah, but, you know, Richard, this gets to the problem of the Bill of Obligations. I read your books, and I think these make sense, but I wonder if anyone from Trump world – I live in both worlds. I go back and forth between both worlds, and I wonder if Trump world ever listens to you, because – if I looked, and this is an AEI problem, by the way, it's a Brookings problem, it's a Beltway Manhattan problem, it's full of people from Blue America, and the payroll is Blue Americans, and they don't get out much. Fair?
Well, again, I spend an awful lot of my time traveling around the country, at least I did before COVID, but I'm not going to fight a related point. I actually think we've got a divided country with blue and red. We've got all sorts of people who never get out of their bubbles. There's a whole academic literature, as you know, about,
yes,
it, about sorting, about how people go to certain churches, certain schools. There's a class dimension. There's a geographic dimension. There's obviously a political dimension. I worry about that. And certain people will listen to certain shows or radio stations or go to social media and go to places that reinforce their beliefs. That, I think, is one of the biggest problems facing this country, that less and less do we have a national or common experience. One of the reasons, you, that I recommend some form of voluntary national service. I want some mechanisms in this country.
And a big chapter on civics. It's a huge chapter on civics, which has me standing up and cheering, because I teach law students, second-year law students. I got to go over how the vote expanded in the United States today, because they don't know. DeCoste. I mean, it's ridiculous, Richard. They do not know.
No, that's one of the things I've learned the last few years is don't assume anything. People don't know. And it's not surprising they don't know. Very few parents are equipped to teach them. The media doesn't cover it. It's too busy covering the latest news or whatever else it's doing. Schools, most universities or colleges, for those Americans who go to them, most of those schools, while they offer courses on civics, don't require them. It's very easy to leave a university now without any civics experience under your belt. Most high schools or elementary schools offer at most a little bit, not very good, not very much. So, yeah, this is a country that's founded on ideas, and I really worry, seriously, that we are not in the business of transmitting those ideas. Why do we take for granted that what made this country what it is will somehow be transmitted from generation to generation?
Now, the Bill of Obligations with a couple of annotations from Hugh would be perfect for an 11th grader. I just don't think the Merrick Garland recitation is complete, Richard, but that's a different day. It's a good book. It's good on civility. Boy, it's good on civility. I'm just so tired, as you must be, of not being able to finish the sentence without somebody interrupting you.
As you'll notice, I didn't interrupt that sentence of yours.
I know. I just want to say Richard Haass comes on and we have a civil conversation. Richard Haass, congratulations. The Bill of Obligations is out today. I just tweeted out the title. You can remember the Bill of Obligations, a fine read for the center. A fine read for the center left and the center right, and a fine read for every civics teacher in America. And I'll be back tomorrow, America, with the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.